questions. If you're sitting comfortably, then I will begin. Suddenly, dear Ajahn Brahm, so many thoughts have started to flood the mind. I love the quiet mind, but since afternoon I have very little quiet moments. Help! Okay, the more you try to stop the mind, the more the thoughts come in. So that's why you just say, mind, it doesn't belong to me, and the thoughts don't belong to me, so it's not my problem. Oh, what wonderful thing that is. It's not your problem, you don't have to do anything. However, I've already mentioned a couple of things you can do. First of all, put space between you and the thoughts. So the thoughts are out here. Have I said that in the talks? I said it in many of the interviews. I think interviews. The talk, okay. Out here is your thoughts. In here is the observer. You put a space between you and the thoughts. Straight away, there's a sense of not getting involved. And in that space, you can put peace, letting go, freedom, kindness, whatever it is you want to put in between. But when there's no space between you and the thoughts, then you're off, you get lost in the thoughts. So separate yourself. In the same way, one of the key stories in opening the door of your heart was the story of my friend who went to Jamaica many, many years ago. And he went to it's the highest murder rate in the world is in Jamaica. And he went to one of the roughest parts of Jamaica with one of his friends. And one evening they went to a movie in one of the old drive-in movie theatres. You know, remember those days, you just go in the car, we sit on the grass, and on this huge screen you see the movies. And he was surprised, because this movie theatre, the drive-in movie theatre, had a concrete screen. Not a cloth screen, a canvas screen, but a concrete screen, maybe 6 inches thick. So that must have cost a fortune. And why did they go to so much trouble to build such a huge screen? And his friend told him the reason why. This was a rough part of a rough country. So everybody had guns. And when they went to the movie, if there was a gunfight in the movie, they joined in. If they didn't like the sheriff, bang, bang, bang. If they didn't like the cowboy, bang, bang, bang. If they didn't like the marshal, bang, bang, bang. It was the first interactive movies before PlayStation. And then they did this. And so this poor owner, he'd gone through so many cross screens, shot to pieces, so he couldn't stop them. So he got this huge concrete screen, so they can just go for their lives. Bang, 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 on interactive movies. Now, that's the same with your thinking. You get involved in it. You have the scenery, your thoughts coming and going, and because you get involved, that is why they go on and on and on and on. So you just stand back. Thoughts are over here, that's on the movie screen. I'm here just watching it, which means you can turn off whenever you want. You don't get involved. But when you get sucked into it, and it feels like you're sucked in, you're right in the middle of the thoughts, going with them, enjoying them, fascinating, wondering where they might lead, adding to them, whatever. That means you've got no objectivity. So one of the great ways of stopping that thoughts, thoughts are over here, I'm over here. Just visualize that, imagine that, get that perspective. And then it's very easy just to stop the thoughts. Ah, they're just thoughts, I recognize them, but I'm not inside of them, they're not mine. Then with that lack of engagement, just like lack of engagement in the movie, you can just walk off and just go and do something else. Have you ever seen that, watching a movie? Yeah, you start there, you're just, you know, sitting on the armchair, or, you know, just have a cup of tea next to you. In a few minutes, you're right in the middle of the TV screen. You're there with the action. And so, when the lovers kiss, oh. When someone gets shot, ah. And when the monster comes, oh. You get involved, don't you? You're part of the movie. That's why it's fun. So remember, don't be part of the thinking movie. Try that, because it's actually very effective. Can you please explain the difference between the fetters of conceit and delusion? I did that this morning. So you must have very strong delusion. Okay, delusion is bigger. That this delusion in... This is actually the definition of delusion. It's think that what is thinking, not view, that your view is okay, but you just forget. The thought that what is non-self, you think it's a self. You think that what is suffering, you think that to be happiness. You think that what is impermanent is permanent. And you think that what's nothing is something. That is delusion. You get it all the wrong way around. That's why you can tell this. When you go home in a couple of days' time, and you tell your friends, oh, where did you go for a holiday? I went to monastery, only eating two meals a day, no TV, no music. And they think, that must have been suffering. And you say, no, it was happiness. Where did you go? I went to Club Med and I played tennis and did that. That must be suffering. No, they say it was happiness. To me, it's suffering. Or I went to some adventure world. Or I went into these death drops which scared the hell out of me. Now that really is suffering, but people take it to be happiness. Why do people do such things? They're people are really weird. Because I remember just reading about, you know, the Club Mediterranean, what people do there from very early in the morning to very late at night. You have to do things. You never have to be free for 5 minutes. Scuba diving, snorkeling, you know, then you have so many lunches, and in the evening you disco and dancing, and God, that must make you really tired out. And that's your holiday. Jeepers, there's something wrong there. So, as a monk, what people take to be pleasurable, I think, is suffering. The birth of your first child. Isn't that one of the most wonderful moments of your life? As far as I'm concerned, you are crazy. 18, 19, 20 years of suffering in front of you. And you think, oh, isn't she sweet? So what monks say is her suffering, you say it's happiness. And what we say is happiness, having no money and no possessions and nothing at all. People say that must be terrible. And we say it's happiness. So this is a different way around. That's actually from the suttas. So that's the delusion there. You know, what you think is happiness is actually suffering. What you think is suffering is happiness. So you get it the wrong way around. That's delusion. And conceit is, I am right. I am better than you. I'm a monk. I sit in a higher seat. I am much better than you. I am worse than you. I'm a terrible monk. I'm awful. Or, we're all the same. Now that's the stupidest conceit. We're not all the same. I haven't got any hair. Most of you have. What do you mean you're all the same? So those are the three real conceits. I am better, I am worse, and I am the same. That's wrong. We are all different. Remember the life of Brian? And Brian's favorite, sort of, they asked him, say something profound. And he said, you're all different. And all the people in the crowd replied, yes, we are all different. They said it in unison. And one of the guys said, I'm not. Do you remember The Life of Brian? The most famous religious movie since the Ten Commandments. Anyway, that's the difference between conceit and delusion. I am an artist by profession, and I rely on people valuing and finding beauty in the handmade objects. Don't worry, there's many stupid people out there, so you'll always have a market. I should say things like that. I'm an artist by profession. I rely on people valuing and finding beauty in the handmade object. However, I feel this is a bit at odds with Buddhism that asks us not to place value on objects and live a simple life without adornment. How do I make peace with these two seemingly conflicting ideas? I mean, you've got to get a living. And so sometimes at least it's bringing happiness to people. And it's a right livelihood. It's not like sort of, you know, exploiting people by just running a slave trade. Or you know, running bars or selling drugs. So it's a pretty good profession. And so you've got like Buddha statues. People find value in those, and so it's great that they make such things. So you're an artist, you rely on people valuing and finding beauty in the handmade objects. Fine, that's not so bad. But you know, eventually, you know, you look at those objects. And what is actually beauty anyway? And sometimes that's one of those questions you ask yourself if you're a bit of a philosopher. What is actually beauty? I remember just going on pilgrimage to India, and then at the end we went to see the Taj Mahal. And I remember just sitting there looking, well, why is that beautiful? Because it was beautiful. And then I said, you know, one of the reasons why it's beautiful is because people tell me it's beautiful. It's been totally conditioned into me. That's one of the most beautiful things in the whole world. Apart from that, why do you think it's beautiful? It's amazing just what beauty is. And of course, I've been old enough now that sometimes you see photographs of some of these models in the 60s. Some of the models I drool over as a young kid. And now I look at them. I wouldn't go out with someone dressed like that. You know, they're flat-breasted. They cut their hair short, like, remember, Twiggy? And I looked at that and thought, yeah, that's yuck. So why is it? What is beauty anyway? I remember just seeing even the girls who were very popular in, I think, the 18th century or 17th century, always fat. The plumper you were, the more attractive. That was the fashion in those days. I don't know, just... It's really tough. What is actually beauty anyway? I don't know, it's just what people say is beauty a lot of the time. So, beautiful object. I don't know. What is a beautiful object? You tell me. Da da da. Anyway, just you've got to do things for a living, so if you sell those things and people buy them, great. I really like the yogi sitting in front of me and another one sitting next to me. They always look very peaceful and kind and gentle. I wish I can stay with them forever. Ah, isn't that nice? So you tell them, just, you tie them down. Or even better, you get some glue and put them on the mat tomorrow morning so they can't move. And so they're always there for you. These things are always... change. But it's very nice that that's a good example of real beauty. Real beauty is not in things, it's in behavior. So as far as I'm concerned, the greatest beauty is in the behavior of people. So not in actually whether they make something beautiful, because that's dead. But you know, that's something where people are being kind, appreciating one another, helping one another. To me, that's beauty. I notice that criticism comes from unhappiness. A monk once brilliantly answered to someone complaining about food, "You're making bad karma by being fault-finding and angry, not by what you eat." And you're making bad karma by fault-finding and being angry, not what you eat. As I said, eating a hamburger. Okay, so somebody was eating a hamburger, and someone criticized him for eating cow. It was a dead, but it had to be killed. And said, "You're making bad karma by being fault-finding and angry, not by me eating a hamburger." That's a really interesting point. Life is so much better and easy when we don't impose on religion, politics, diet, rituals or views on others, but have loving kindness in our heart and knowing that the world is not there to change, but to understand, accept and let go. Knowing that the world is inherently suffering and uncontrollable is a great relief. Whoever wrote that, he should become a monk. Or a nun, whatever. That's monk stuff. Was it one of the nuns? I don't know. But anyway, so that's actually true, that sometimes we just really are very critical. And sometimes, try and change diet, you try and change this, you try and do your very best. And haven't you done that in life? You're trying your very best. You can't be perfect. No one's perfect. I tried my hard to get jokes and to really just filter them out so I don't tell you the really bad ones. But, actually, the ones I don't tell you, they must be terrible. Because, out of compassion, I don't sell them to you. There we go. So because of that, the sort of people can be very fault-finding. So it's a rotten thing to be fault-finding. It means you're not appreciating one another and you're not appreciating yourself. You can never find any peace. I often tell that story that I would be working really, really hard building up Bodhinyana Monastery years ago. So for 5 days a week, mostly for the morning and afternoon, evenings, I was just working really hard. And on Saturday and Sunday or Friday night, you go to Nanamar and give talks. and just do things all weekend. And then Monday morning you'd be back at work building. And it was like 7 days a week. And then I realized that what I had to do to relax and rest, I decided Monday morning I would go for a walk around the monastery of Bodhinyana. But I would go for a walk as a visitor, not as an abbot. So as an abbot, I'd see all the things which were wrong, which needed fixing. An abbot, a manager, has to have a fault-finding mind. You've got to fix things up. That's your job. So imagine if you were like a plumber or like an IT expert and you lost your fault-finding mind. I can't see any leak. It's just water coming out the pipe. What's wrong with that? Yeah, so your computer doesn't work. Yeah, that's just impermanence. What's the big deal? No, if you're in that job, you can't let go and just allow things to be and just, oh, be kind to your computer. Now you've got to fix the damn thing. But if, you know, that's being a fault finder. But if you're a visitor, you don't find fault. You just, this is your holiday. You're appreciating the monastery. You come there for a nice afternoon. You don't have to fix anything. So on those Monday mornings, I walked around Bodhinyana Monastery as a visitor, not looking at what needed to be swept, fixed, painted or whatever, but I looked at all the things which had been achieved over the many years, all the things which had been done. And you know that creates so much peace and happiness. Look at this place over here. Just how much work went into this, and it's only 2 years old. And sometimes even yesterday, I went for a walk and saw actually there was a path needed to be made just to get up from the lower huts, and I still got to fix up the roof on that teacher's cottage, and there's some glass needs to be replaced because it's broken. Let's stop it, Ajahn Brahm. I'm going for a walk, I'm not working. So I got to stop myself. A fault-finding mind never finds any peace. There's always things to be fixed up. So, there's one of the stories. This is from the suttas, and this is actually a good story. I don't mind some wasting time. It's not actually wasting time, but taking time. There was this monk, and he lived in one of these monasteries a long time ago in the time of the Buddha, where it was like one building with many rooms. And in the morning, and just after lunch and in the evening, he'd sweep. He'd spend many hours sweeping, and that vihara, you know, was spotless. Then one of the monks staying there was one of the chief monks of the Buddha, Mahakachana. And he's told this monk, he said, look, you didn't become a monk to sweep all day. You're supposed to be meditating. So I'll teach you how to meditate. And he taught this monk how to meditate. And in a short time, that monk became fully enlightened. And he only swept once a day. From that time on, the vihara was never as clean. But we had one more enlightened being. And that's why the Buddha told that story. Is it really more important to have a beautiful, perfect retreat center, or is it more important to have beautiful, perfect people? When I read that story, I remembered, people are more important than things. Please always remember that. In any organization, a family, people are more important. So don't exploit yourself, exploit others, just to get a beautiful house or a successful company. You're the most important. People are. I really try to remember that. So I will never exploit you to get a beautiful center. The center's for you, you're not for the center. So that's why you just get rid of the fault-finding mind, you appreciate things, it's good enough. The more important thing is have this peace rather than have a well-swept vihara. Nevertheless, if you are on duties tomorrow, please do them. Ajahn Brahm says it's more important than I wash the toilet, so I wash the dishes. I got to be smart. I knew what you were thinking. This question. My parents' relationship was rocky and it severely affected me. At 45 years of age, my mother moved into a separate bedroom. She always put us kids before my father. We were number one because of this. I find it impossible to trust women. I think they are self-serving and hide behind a facade of fake life for men. They are really after a house and money and an easy life. How would I know? Now remember, some questions are designed to stir people up. So did you have a fault-finding mind? Were you upset? If it was, the person who asked this question was just trying to find out whether you were a non-returner yet. So if you got angry, you got more work to do. Yeah, sometimes it's our opinions and our attitude are really brought up by our past, and some people have a lovely relationship with their parents, sometimes have a dysfunctional one. And that does leave scars. It does affect one's attitude to oneself and to others, which is a great shame. It's a shame we can't just let that go and just deceive people for who they are. I can't see women. I can't see men. I can just see people. And it's wonderful when you can do that. So there's no gender. I can't see gays. I can't see old people, young people. You just see human beings. You don't even see bodies. You see hearts. So there is no such thing as a woman. There's no such thing as a man. It's just beautiful people, hearts. And you all know inside, there's this beautiful, soft heart. It just really wants to be good, wants to be kind, wants to be loved and respected. And it's just covered up by all this other stuff, you know, our history, our biases, our fault-finding. So just get rid of all that sort of stuff and go to the heart of the matter. And human beings, even not just human beings, dogs, cats, chickens and rabbits. Isn't there something when you see those little chickens out there you can recognise in yourself? What are you recognising yourself? Just people who just, you know, just want to eat and be happy and be peaceful. They just want to be cared for and left alone. That's why they come up to you. They come up to you wanting compassion, protection. So wouldn't it be wonderful if you would go up to someone and they'd cuddle and stroke you? But don't do that, because you've got sexual abuse and all these other things you've got to worry about these days. Oh God, it gets so terrible. Just be kind. So maybe don't do that, but smile at each other. Next question. Why 7 lifetimes? Why? Because it's between 6 and 8. That's a profound answer. Okay, that's an old kid's joke. You know the old kid's joke. Why was six afraid of 7? That's right, because 7, 8, 9. Okay, got it? Why was 6 afraid of 7? Because 7, 8, 9. Okay, forget it. You're obviously not as intelligent as the kid who told me that. I can't stop controlling my mind. Ah, how do you do it? Trying to stop controlling is another type of controlling. Let the mind control itself. Just let go and give up. Just people just think they drive themselves crazy. So stop. Always use reverse psychology. If you can't stop it, then try to do it. So you're trying to stop controlling your mind. So try to control your mind. And then you realize you can't. So you can't control it. You can't stop controlling it. You can't do anything. So just let it go. Just instead, be kind to your mind. It might be the time to tell one of the strategies when you're going crazy. And by this time of a retreat, there are many people who are going crazy. They haven't got any meditation at all. They've still got 2 days to go. How the hell am I going to get through these? So there is something which I invented called the Nalagiri strategy. And that comes from the story which some of you may have read as kids. When somebody tried to kill the Buddha, and they tried to kill the Buddha by intoxicating an elephant. They gave it all sorts of alcohol, maybe drugs, maybe, what they call it, amphetamines, ice, I don't know what they call it, something like that, anyway. So they intoxicated this elephant just early in the morning, and they set the elephant loose on the narrow streets of Rajagaha, this great city, right in the path of the Buddha. The Buddha was walking very slowly and mindfully on arms round. In the opposite direction, this mad elephant charging along, destroying everything, trampling on things, smashing things with his trunks,
destruction all the way.
And there was the Buddha, walking mindfully. That could be like a movie, isn't it? Because they go from scene to scene, and there was the Buddha, walking mindfully. And
people were running away, climbing up trees, jumping over walls. And when they saw the Buddha and the monks, get out of the way, there's a mad elephant coming this direction, you get trampled, you get hurt, escape while there's still time.
And what did these very peaceful, calm monks do?
They jumped over the walls, they climbed the trees, they ran away.
All except who? The Buddha and his faithful attendant, Ananda. Because Ananda, he loved his master. He wouldn't abandon his master in such a situation. So with the elephant charging in front towards them, Ananda stepped in front of his master. Let the elephant kill me. I will protect my master, my beloved Buddha. What a beautiful act of heroism that was. So the Buddha pushed him out of the way and said, thank you very much, that's very sweet, but I can look after this by myself. So poor Ananda lost his moment of glory. And so there they were, high noon in Rajagaha. It wasn't a high noon, but you know that movie. The Buddha versus the elephant. Who would win? It was like some cup final or grand final, like some bout with two boxers. Who would be the strongest, this incredibly powerful elephant or the wise Buddha? Now, you should know, for those of you who've read about the Buddha, that was one powerful being. He had psychic powers, strong psychic powers. If the Buddha had wanted to, he could have grabbed the elephant by the trunk, lift him above his head like some Superman, and three times, he always did things three times around his head, and then way, flaming like a discus over the Ganges River a couple of hundred miles away. That'd be simple for something like a Buddha. He can do things like that. But that is violence. Buddhas don't do that. Instead, the Buddha, according to the text, he did something like this. As this elephant was charging towards him, only seconds until impact, the Buddha said, or thought, Nadagiri, whatever you do to me, the door of my heart is always open to you. You can squash me with your enormous feet, and I will still love you. You can take my body in your strong trunk and smash it against a tree. I will always forgive you. Because Nadagiri, whatever you do, whoever you are, the door of my heart is always totally open to you. I give you unconditional love. And unconditional means it doesn't matter what you do. It was pure metta. And for those of you who know what happened next, maybe I should tell you tomorrow. Episode 2. No. What happened next was that with such strong compassion that no one can resist that. In a second or two, Nadagiri had stopped in front of the Buddha with his head bowed down, tired, obviously confused. And the Buddha was just stroking his trunk. There, Nadagiri. There, it's all right, Nadagiri. Soft and kind. Now, that is how you deal with your crazy mind. Thinking, worrying, falling asleep, going totally berserk, thinking you better check into the local mental hospital when you leave here. Going really out of control. So what do? You don't go and try and pick it up and throw it away. Don't use aggression. Don't use force or violence. Do not use your will. Instead, use kindness. There, my crazy mind, thinking about all sorts of stupid things. Mind, whatever you do, the door of my heart is fully open. You can drive me bananas. You can make me psychotic. But mind, I will always love you. And if you do something like that, within a second or two, your mind will be bending before you. And you're just stroking it there, mind. Shh. Never mind, mind. Shh. I'll always love you. And the mind purrs. And that's what you do. And actually, that works. So, loving kindness to your crazy mind. But 100%, 99.99999 doesn't work. The door of my heart is totally open, mind, whatever you do. Whatever you do. Now that's called not controlling, letting things be. That's called compassion. So when you go crazy, that's what you should do. Okay, here we go, another one about the prostitutes. So the person who said the prostitutes are the victims of sexual assault, the women I... Well, there's some crazy people in this retreat. I think they really do need to go to... I'll take that back now. We'll call the people now. But I've got to read this out. To the person who said prostitutes are the victims of sexual assault, the women I pay for sex earn $250,000 to $300,000 per year. These women exploit men and often don't give very good service. Men are the victims. There's always another side to every story. Maybe I'll keep that one because he says that he goes to have sex and pays $250,000. I'm going to keep this one and I'll find out the handwriting. I'll maybe get fingerprints. Nice, it's people having fun and games. But there's always a different side because sometimes you criticize one person. They say, no, it's another. It always takes two or three or four or five. That's nothing to do with sex. Don't start thinking that bit, but it's just with any problem. If anxiety and anxiety attacks are conditioned, what is the point of believing the suffering that they are when they are experienced? Now, what do we mean here? If anxiety and anxiety attacks are conditioned, what is the point of believing in the suffering that they are when they are experienced? Okay, they are unpleasant because, you know, they sort of... They limit you. You can't do anything. You freeze. You can't sort of, you're sitting down. And a lot of times it's embarrassment. You know, what people think of me. And just, look, please be kind to yourself. People are usually pretty good and kind. If they see you having a panic attack and freezing, they'll probably be sort of, most people will be just quite compassionate and just look after you. So never ever think about what people think of me. Look how I dress. And I go into the shops everywhere in these clothes. Some people say, have you got anything else to wear? And I actually do. I do have another suit, and that's birthday suit. In other words, nothing. It's either these or nothing. So you have to have these wherever I go. So sometimes you get people ridiculed. I remember one of those times I was visiting my cousin in Stoke-on-Trent. That's in the Midlands of England. And I was staying with him, and we went for a walk in the morning. You know, nice exercise. And as I was walking through the streets of this town in the middle of England, people started looking at me and laughing and ridiculing me. They looked, hey, look at him. And I wasn't embarrassed, but it was really strange because nothing that extreme had ever happened anywhere else. And I was wondering what was going on until we passed this big billboard which advertised that the circus was in town that weekend. And I realized they thought that I was one of the clowns. That's what they're pointing at me, laughing at them. But as when I found that out, I thought, wonderful, I made people happy. So, you don't worry about what other people think of you. But anxiety and anxiety attacks are conditioned. Yeah, they have their causes and effects. And that's actually how you can actually avoid them. Finding out their causes and avoiding the causes. That's through mindfulness and reflection. But the suffering that they are, yeah, they still hurt whether you believe in it or not. That's why, you know, you can actually say, oh, I'm going to the surgery. It's not going to hurt. I don't need anaesthetic. No, just all this thing about pain. It's all in the mind. Yeah, you try that. Best of luck. I'm going to take the anaesthetic. Would meditation help to prevent dementia? Thank you. I forgot. Would it help dementia? I don't really know. Who are you anyway? Yes, it usually does. According to the Buddhist teaching, what is the order of organs shutting down at the time of death? Is that the same principle applied to the time of reaching jhana? Also, the senses, how they shut that down, the organs shut down. I mean, the first thing which has to shut down before you enter jhana is your mouth. Shut up. No, the order of the senses. It's usually like sight, smell and taste. They can go very easily. But the hard ones are the physical sensations and hearing. And the physical sensations go first. You lose your body sensation first. And the last thing which goes is the hearing. Because the hearing is the body's last line of defense for keeping you safe. Which is why you wake up in the morning because the alarm clock. And because the sound can actually penetrate deeper. Because even in the dark, we can't feel anything. But in the dark forest, we hear the sound. Something is coming. It's the sound which actually we won't let go of because that's our last line of defense. So you have to let go of your attachment to your body to let go of sound. And then it totally disappears. Dear Ajahn, in the past I have printed Sutra of Filial Piety, Mahayana Buddhism, to dedicate merits to my deceased mother. Is there a similar sutra in Theravada? Does this work, especially if she's reincarnated? The Sutra of Filial Piety, to dedicate, Mahayana Buddhism. There's nothing quite the same in Theravada Buddhism, because that filial piety business, a lot of that came from the Confucianism of in China at the time. Yeah, there was filial respect in Buddhism. And they called that respect, it's got a Pali word called Garu Karoti, which literally means you make it heavy. And I like that word because, you know, understanding the Pali of it, making it heavy means what your parents say, what they advise, is heavy. When you weigh everything in the balance, you know, parents or whatever, your teachers, you know, your favorite monks or nuns, what they say has maybe twice the weight than everything anybody else. So you take their advice more seriously. But it doesn't mean that they're right. Maybe all the other advice can still outweigh your parents' advice, or my advice, or anyone else who you really respect. So yeah, you give it more weight, but it doesn't mean you can't overturn it by other evidence. So that's what respect to me was in original Buddhism. And that makes so much more sense. Because even a Buddha wasn't pious to his parents. You know, he left his wife and kid and his parents to go off and become a monk. Was that filial piety? If the Buddha was born in China, would he ever become a Buddha? Probably not. I remember actually, what was it? That was the Archbishop Herf told that story. He said he was a Christian. He was talking about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. That's in the famous Christian story. He said, if Adam and Eve were Chinese, he said, there wouldn't have been any problem with original sin. As soon as they saw the snake, they would have eaten it. That's a great joke for the Archbishop. I like that one. Anyhow, I think you get the story there. So filial piety, yeah, its piety, I think, goes too much with, especially, and I'd say this in Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, especially that some Chinese parents, when their son comes along and says, I want to become a monk, I will die if you become a monk, says a mother. No way, says a father. Now that is bad karma for the parents, stopping someone doing a good thing. But they think that's filial piety. And I know many children have said, I really want to become monks, I want to become a nun. But out of filial piety, because their mother and their father don't want it to happen, that's why they don't. And that is very, very sad. That's filial piety gone too far. So remember, yes, you listen to your parents. And you really sort of take what they say with extra weight. But sometimes they go too far. But anyway, if you dedicate the merits as they get to these people, yes, sometimes it does, but it doesn't matter, it's a great thing to do. Dear Ajahn, regarding stream entry, there are many questions, so perhaps you could do a talk on this. Well, I sort of did it a little bit this morning. Anyway, how come some only have the momentum for stream entry, while others sail through to enlightenment, this very life? Is it the case that those enlightened this life enter the stream 7 lives before? Does a stream win? Oh, it's one question after another. First of all, how come some only have the momentum for stream entry, while others sail through to enlightenment this very life? It's because of some of the things they've developed over their previous lives. Sometimes they're extremely wise, very faithful. All those, what they call it, like the spiritual qualities, the parameters. And you don't need to name them, because actually Mahayana started the parameters with 6, and then Theravada came in. We have to do better, so we had 10. It's just keeping up with, you know, the opposition. That's what it was in those days. So it doesn't really matter. The parameters, spiritual qualities, you know, like generosity, like kindness, like stillness, like wisdom, like endurance. These are the things which you build up. And if they are very, very strong, obviously you just sail through and go very quickly, because you've got the momentum because of all those years of training, all your goodness. So yeah, that's why some people go quick, some people go slow. Is it the case that those enlightened this life enter the stream 7 lives before? Not necessarily so. Sometimes they just have so much momentum, they just first time stream winner in this life, and then they go on to become enlightened. But what about the Buddha? When he was born into this realm, his last life, was he a stream winner? Once returner? Was he nothing at all? Now that is one of those controversial questions, because I was taught that the Buddha was nothing at all and he did everything in this life all by himself. But that doesn't fit the evidence, because in the previous life of the Buddha, in Thailand you have the Waisantara, and that is much, much older, and that does not fit the truth of the suttas. Because it's one of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Gatikara Sutta. And it was Sadi's brother. He first pointed this out to me. Now, your brother over in Malaysia. Now, he once pointed out, he said, look, this Gatikara Sutta. Gatikara, this was a Buddha relating to Ananda, this story, in a long time ago, in the time of the previous Buddha, Kassapa. Gatikara was a potter, and he was a non-returner, and he was a close disciple of Kassapa the Buddha. Now, one of the chief ones, but a lay person. He didn't become a monk because his two parents were blind, and he had to look after his mum and dad. He was the only person who could look after them, and he was a potter. And this was like a non-returner. This is a description of what a non-returner does. He says that he wouldn't even dig the earth to get the clay in case he killed a worm. So he'd wait for like the rats or the mice to dig up the earth, or when the people were making the dikes on the paddy fields, if there was any earth left over, he would take that. And that's what he would make his pots from. And he would never sell the pots. He would never get involved in money and business. He was so pure, a non-returner. He'd leave the pots on a bench and said, anyone wants a pot, take one. If you want to leave some rice and lentils for me and my parents, you can leave some. It wasn't really barter. It was just, whatever you want to do, take it. And if you want to leave something, leave it. And that's how he got by. And he had a best friend called Jyotipala. And he was always trying to get his best friend to go and see the Buddha. Like somebody said, they're trying to get their husband to come to the temple and do some meditation, but they just won't come. And that was like this Jyotipala. He just would never come to see the Buddha. And he would criticize the Buddha. You know, just a bald-headed idiot. This Jyotipala would say bad things about the Buddha, Kassapa. And then one day that Gatikara, he actually pulled his friend by the hair. You're come to see the Buddha. And Jyotipala think, you go to such extremes? This Buddha actually must really be somebody. So he went to see the Buddha Kassapa for the first time. So impressed that he got faith in the Buddha Kassapa and became a monk himself. And the Buddha said, this is our Buddha Gotama said, that was me in my past life. Buddha Gotama, Gotama Buddha, was a disciple of the previous Buddha. And even that's also confirmed in the Devaputta Sanghita, just after the Buddha's enlightenment, Gatikara came to see the Buddha. He said, in a previous life we were from the same village, we were best of friends. Now I'm now in the pure abodes, I'm an Anagami, you become a Buddha. Congratulations. Well, that's actually consistent. So, the Buddha of our age was a monk with another Buddha. Surely he would have learned something. Surely he would have become at least a stream winner or once returned. Now, if you're actually practicing with a real Buddha, that must be something. And when he was under the Bodhi tree, actually that's one of the reasons why, when he was born according to the tradition, he raised his finger and said, "This is my last life." How could he have done that? Unless he really was a once returner. So there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that the Buddha was a once returner. And in the first watch of the night under the Bodhi tree, before he became enlightened, he remembered his past lives. And there was a very recent past life with the previous Buddha. He's supposed to remember it in all his detail. So he would remember what Kassapa the Buddha taught him. So the Buddha didn't discover the Four Noble Truths. He remembered them. Now that, some people say, Ajahn Brahm, you're doing it again. You're a heretic. But it makes a lot of sense. Think about it. See what you think. Anyway, what else we got here? Does a stream winner have 6 more human lives, or can they live some of these lives in other realms? Yes, they can go Deva realm, then come back here for another go, and then another Deva realm, another human realm, and then another Deva realm, or another Deva realm. And sometimes they can get enlightened in the Deva realms. So 6 human lives, or 6 lives, but not in the lower realms. They can't get reborn as a dog. If so, which realms? I already said that. If one can be a stream winner who has reborn and forgotten insight into non-self, can they not feel guilt due to self-view and fall to perdition as a result? No, because they have to get to a stream winner in this life, so everything they did before stream winning they can forgive and let go of. Why, the more I do meditation, the harder I fall to sleep at night? Because you're sleeping too much. You don't need to sleep. So that happens when you meditate a lot. You're so peaceful and rested, you don't need to sleep so much. The only reason you need to sleep is because you use your brain too much. If you don't use your car, do you really need to put so much petrol in it? Of course not. If the car is idling, then it doesn't use up so much gas. So you don't need to spend so much time in the petrol station filling it. So if you're just a very peaceful mind, not doing very much all day, just watching this present moment, being still, you don't get so tired. That's why you don't need to sleep so much. You can lie down to rest the body and meditate in bed. You can always catch up on your sleep later. And the best place to catch up on your sleep is in your coffin. Then you can sleep as long as you like. I read in a book that our personality remains the same throughout our life. At first I was surprised by this. When I later reflected on this in my own life, it made sense. Does the personality follow us into the next life? If we are friendly and kind now, then we would not be reborn unfriendly and mean, would we? We could each improve with each rebirth. If your personality can't change in this life, you're really stuck, aren't you? My goodness, you're in big trouble. But of course your personality can change in this life. Otherwise, there'll be no jobs for personality coach, therapists, or even monks and nuns. If that was really true, you're wasting your time here. I am changing your personality. You come in here, one product, and you go out much improved, just like you send your laundry to the laundromat. It goes in there dirty, and it comes out shining and clean and fragrant. So that's exactly what happens here. This is Jhana Grove Laundromat, where we clean up your mind to become fragrant and pure, maybe. But anyway, yes, your personality can change. I don't know who wrote that book. Obviously, they're not Buddhist or meditators. Instead of saying attaining nirvana, should we say lost to nirvana or jhanas, thanks, or lost to jhanas, thanks? Yeah, you can say whatever you like, but it's best not to say anything at all. Ajahn Brahm, why some couples can have a baby earlier while others not? Gee, what's this got to do with what are you thinking when you're meditating? Gee. It is related to their past karma. I think it would be very complicated if the couples and the baby's karma need to be matched. Thank you for your explanation. Yeah, I think I'll leave that one. Ajahn, you said last night to watch the space between you and the object. Yeah, said it tonight as well. The relationship, but isn't how I relate to life, the attitude, mindfulness, kindness and gentleness that I bring to it? Hence I take responsibility for not sowing the seed of karma. I don't understand what you mean by the space, the relationship, explain. Okay, I think I've already mentioned that because it's the involvement. When you're involved with something, you merge into it and you can't distinguish the movie from the person watching the movie. You can't actually distinguish the thought from the person observing the thought. And because of that, you get lost. You really do get lost in thought, which is not a nice thing to do. So it means you've got no sort of idea of what's right and what's wrong. You're just totally almost crazy with thinking. So actually, when you can actually separate yourself, and just the space is just one way of imagining, of looking at it. And it's that perspective can really help you. Could you please explain your understanding of the factors of jhana? Which jhana? The first jhana is five factors according to the usual description. And the first of those factors is vitakka, vichara. In ordinary usage, that does mean like thinking and pondering, but in the case of the jhanas, it has a different meaning. Just the same way as the meaning of cats and dogs, in the phrase, it's raining cats and dogs, does not mean animals falling from the sky. The words have a different meaning in the context. In the same way that vitakka vichara, otherwise said thinking and pondering, has a different meaning in the context of jhanas. And that is even reflected in the Chinese translation of that term, which uses a different Chinese character for the words vitakka vichara in jhana to other cases when it's just ordinary consciousness. So what it really means is a movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object. And what is the object? That's the second, the third and the fourth factor is piti sukha, this bliss. It's twofold, but in there you just can see it as one. And the last one is ekakata. It's a one peak of mind, not in time, but in space. Because that one pointedness of mind, people always think spatially, they think it's just one thing and nothing else. They don't realize it's one in time. In other words, it doesn't change. Otherwise known as stillness. Stillness means one pointedness in time. Just one thing and the same thing and the same thing and the same thing and the same thing afterwards. That's called stillness. So those are the factors of the first jhana. I don't know if that helps you, probably doesn't, but you asked the question, now you've got the answer. Ajahn Brahm, gusto! Do your Buddha airbuses stop anywhere as we choose or just up to our karma or the planes of existence assign? Do we buy a one-way ticket only on Buddha Air? Can't we stop somewhere to visit friends and transit later? Cheerio. I am sorry. But Buddha Air, once it takes off, it only goes to one destination, the terminus of Nirvana. That's the only place Buddha Air goes. I'm sorry, you cannot hijack it and take it to see your friends. Remember, there's nobody in the cockpit, so if you go and hold a knife up to somebody, there's no one to hold a knife up to. You can't change the destination. I'm sorry, you're all on Buddha Air now, so it's too late. I'm terribly sorry. You're stuck now. Buddha Air to Nirvana. You can't go back. Oh, why didn't you tell me this beforehand? So, unfortunately, you can't jump out of the Airbus. It's too late. Next question. Thank you for your wonderful food we have been having at lunch. I'm sure, is that what you think about? And this, it's supposed to be a meditation retreat, meditation questions. This is about food. Goodness. I'm sure the people offering dana were cooking with you in mind, putting extra love and mindfulness. Of course, we all have very good karma too, to be taking great, delicious, exotic dishes. Yes, you do. People, actually, it is really amazing. All these people who come here to feed us, not only do they have to get up really early to start the cooking, and they come 1 hour from town just to come here and feed you all, and really special food. It's amazing. And they don't get paid for this. They get a little bit of a chanting from me. And then you go in there. Do you chant for them? No, you just eat. And they wash all the dishes afterwards. No, I think you give them loving kindness. Please show them gratitude that they come here and they feed you all. Isn't it beautiful? In most other retreats, you have cooks and you have to pay for that. Here it's all done for free, out of love. That's really something special. So, if the food is not to your liking, remember, as one monk once said, it's always pure food here. Why is it pure? Because it's cooked with a pure heart. And it's served with a pure heart. That's what makes it pure. Don't care what the ingredients are. It's pure because it comes from a pure heart. Dear Ajahn, wonderful retreat, but so few people taking advantage of your teaching. The Dharma Hall could hold so many more, especially with its 3 adjoining rooms. The lunchroom also could hold more. My tummy could hold more. No, that's not what it says. Yet it's so hard to get in with bookings full within a few minutes of opening and a logging waiting list, a long waiting list. Why not let a few people camp? The Thai people held camping retreats here for ages, and the bush is very suitable. Also, some of us are experienced campers. Thanks. Yeah, but look, the line for the interviews is already too long. So the more people have interviews, the more trouble we have. No, we have to have regulations over here. Those people camping there, that's a bit illegal, but no one really noticed that. Because when we got permission for this, we had to say how many people, and the health department comes in to check we've got enough toilets, and the water's okay, and the kitchen's okay. And if we have camping, there's all sorts of other permits you need, and so bushfires as well. So it's not, doesn't really work. So 60, the elite. And if you want more retreats, we need more teachers. And if we need more teachers, we need more monks and nuns. So if you really want to make better use of this facility, it's about time you ordained. You know that we have a rule in Bodhinyana Monastery. If any monk has an idea, say, we need to put a shelf in the dining area, or we need to build a place for the bins, if the other monks agree it's a good idea, the one who suggested it has to do it. That stops a lot of ideas. So if you think we should have more retreats, you teach them, or at least you organize them and do all the cooking. Stops a lot of ideas, though. But it's true. I mean, but look, I have to teach all over the place, and I just get quite sort of tired sometimes, all the work. Anyway, thank you for your liberal view on homosexuality. I never understood why it could be wrong for two people to love each other just because of their gender. However, do you think people attracted to their own gender is because of bad karma, given the widespread stigma and discrimination they attract? Also, what do you think about transsexualism and gender reassignment, which appear to be more prevalent in certain countries? I was a heterosexual, so I was actually scared of gays and homosexuals when I was growing up, just being honest, because now, the culture I was in and not really understanding, it was only when you became a monk and your mind was much more open. And you see some people who are homosexual and they were wonderful people. What's wrong with them? And then you read the Buddha's teachings. And it says, the door of my heart must be open to all people. So what am I discriminating for? So, you know, once you became a monk, all that discrimination, which was a lot of delusion and conceit and arrogance, totally disappeared. And so as part of my character, if someone's having a hard time, I'll stick up for them. Sometimes I get in a lot of trouble that way. So if a homosexual was having a bad time, I would stand up for them. And I did that once. And I actually stood up against the Dalai Lama, because it was an article written in the, I think, the Telegraph in London, which was reprinted here in West Australia, and it said that homosexual people can't be Buddhists, period. And that's what they printed it in the West Australian paper here. And of course you can imagine, just many of our members who were gay, they rang me up and said, what is this? Is this true? I said, of course it's not true. So you better do something about it. So I wrote this letter to the West Australian to say the Dalai Lama's wrong. You know, nothing wrong with being a homosexual. You know, you get so much rubbish and so much stigma in other religions, at least in Buddhism, you know, you can have some respect and love. So I wrote that out there. And I got some calls from some Tibetan Buddhists. You can't criticize the Dalai Lama. You can't say he's wrong. I said, look, you can criticize anybody. We don't have popes. You can criticize me. You can criticize whoever. But then as a result of that, I got my first invitation to the gay and lesbian breakfast. Just before, you know, the gay pride week. It's gay pride week. So they're proud of that. And so I had to give a little speech, and there's a gay pride breakfast with all the gays and lesbians and goodness knows what else. And so I went up there, and I remember I said, you think you're deviant. I am more deviant than everyone in this room because I'm celibate. And they all thought that's funny. I thought it was funny too. You don't. I don't. Because of all the sexual orientations in Australia, having no sex at all, that's the weirdest. That's the one which people think you're really, really strange. You can be homosexual, you can be gay, do all sorts of weird things, but having no sex at all, that really challenges people. So I've actually made this offer, I think, maybe on the next gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, we should have a float, a stall for celibates. No, I don't think they'll let me on that one. However, do you think, okay, yeah, so it's not bad karma, it's just, especially not here in West Australia. So you're totally accepted, and I'll stand up for you. You mentioned yesterday that there's no such thing as a will. I didn't say there's no such thing as a will. I said that will, you're giving it a meaning it doesn't observe. There's no you behind your will. I've always thought that it is Buddhist view that you have a preconditioned will. Exactly. It is either you or one of the monks mentioned that there is that tiny space between stimuli and reaction. Yeah, I mentioned that too. That's Libet's theory. It's that space that gives you a chance, and you can train to strengthen that space through the practice of mindfulness, e.g. meditation. For example, you cannot choose what thoughts would arise, but you can choose your reaction to those thoughts. Please explain. Actually, you don't choose a reaction to your thoughts. You're conditioned to change your reaction to the thoughts, and that's why you listen to the Dhamma. So I was conditioned by Ajahn Chah. Now I'm brainwashing you. And all the other monks and teachers are brainwashing you too. Ajahn Chah was brainwashed by Ajahn Mun. He was brainwashed by his teacher, and that all goes back to the Buddha, Gautama. The Buddha brainwashed his first disciples. Now it's come back to us. Who brainwashed the Buddha? I've just told you that was Buddha Kassapa. It just goes on and on and on. To change the way you look at things. So it's actually that, you know, you find that there is a will, but it's not you doing the will. It's not what you think it is. But it doesn't matter. You've got no choice. You have to see it one day. How many schools of Buddhism fall under Theravada tradition? Are Thai forest monks one of these schools? Thank you. Are these schools of Buddhism business and all these sects? Look, I'm a monk. I don't have sects. Either S-E-X or S-E-C-T-S. So that's one of the things we're really trying to stop in Western Buddhism, all these differences between this sect and that sect, even that type of Buddhism. Was it not last range retreat or two range retreats ago, we had these two Korean Mahayana monks staying in our monastery. And you saw them there, they were different ways, but they were just mates. They were just one of us. They joined in everything we did. I was so proud of that because it felt right, it was right, and it was a beautiful thing to do. Mahayana monks and Theravada monks living just as brothers with no distinction at all. Why do we always have to separate gays, lesbians, transsexuals, straights, girls and boys, Asians, Caucasians, Africans, old and young. Why do you always have to separate these things? Especially in the Sangha. We're monks, we're nuns. It doesn't matter where you come from. And actually, since the bhikkhuni ordination, we really had to look at the Vinaya more closely. And there is no such thing as a Mahayana monk, or a Theravada monk, or a Tibetan monk. They are monks, first and foremost. Monks who practice Tibetan, monks who practice Mahayana, monks who practice Theravada. They are monks first, bhikkhus. We are all brothers first. The fact of being a bhikkhu, being a monk, that is the big thing. We just happen to be preferring that teaching or this teaching. But we are brothers. Same as bhikkhunis. There's no such thing as Mahayana bhikkhunis or Theravada bhikkhunis. There's bhikkhunis who practice Theravada, bhikkhunis who practice Mahayana. And once you actually see that, you can understand just why you can restart the bhikkhuni tradition from any of those orders, and that there is a fellowship there. And you know, that's what I felt. You go and visit Mahayana monasteries or Tibetan monasteries. Yeah, it's different roads, but you feel a fellowship. I feel I'm one of them. And I like to make sure that they feel they're one of us when they come and visit Bodhinyana. And the distinction of their tradition is very little compared to the fact they're Buddhist monks or Buddhist nuns. And that actually, that's what you feel, and that's what the texts say, and that's how it should be. And look, in Thailand, Mahanikaya Dhammayu, it's just politics, that's all. It's just they're trying to have power and prestige. There's no difference there. Thai, the forest tradition, the city tradition, there was a bit of a difference when I grew up between the forest and the city. But now the forest tradition in Thailand, I'm going to get into trouble again, but I don't care. The forest tradition in Thailand got wealthy now, and so sometimes they are better looked after than the city monks. So if you want to live simply, you go live in the city. Because the forest monks, they get so much support these days. So they have the best mobile phones, big cars, and lovely air conditioners in their huts. Never used to be like that. But, you know, what happens is when you're ascetic and simple, people think, ah, you're the real monks. And so they give you all of the donations. And they spoil the good monks. So the Thai forest tradition, pure, but spoiled because of all of the attention and all of the donations and gains. So look, please don't spoil your monks and your nuns by giving them too much. And I'm saying that because I'm a monk. So look after them. Put the money into the temples, into facilities like the nuns' monastery projects coming up. But don't give us expensive things. Please remember that, because you can very easily, you can destroy, you know, your sanghas. So they don't need expensive things. Anyway, that's the schools of Buddhism. Just like to share on the bhikkhuni ordination, there is this book titled Dignity and Discipline, in which a bhikkhuni does research on the topic. The Buddha might have meant that to prevent the Dhamma from disappearing, whatever, because of bhikkhuni's ordination, the 8 prerequisite conditions need to be fulfilled. So it's more like a preventative measure than ordinating women anyway. It's one view. Okay, that's one of the books, Dignity and Discipline. It's also got Bhikkhu Bodhi's address at the Hamburg conference, which was, for me, very significant in just explaining the point I just made to you. There's no such thing as Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana bhikkhus. It's just bhikkhus or bhikkhunis who happen to be following that tradition. So if, in other words, if someone is like, let's say I decided, no, I want to practice the Tibetan tradition. I don't need to disrobe. I'm a bhikkhu. So I can just change the colour of my robes and go and practice with them. You don't need to reordain. You're a monk, you're a disciple of the Buddha. That's a nice thing. So your advice to quickly get to stillness before the body starts to ache from your story of travelling for hours only to arrive in time for 4-hour marathon meditation didn't work for me because it's very hard to quickly let go. It led to suffering and craving when I reflected on my meditation. At least you can let go of trying to let go. If it doesn't work, don't worry about it. You tried, it's wonderful. Well done, you're a good meditator. So don't try and attain things. Just let go of things. It's okay to be stupid.
It's all right not to attain anything. Just be content to be here. You're just having a beautiful time here and you're trying to attain so much. You spoil the peace and the happiness of this place when you're trying to be somewhere where you're not. So remember the core teachings. Just be in this moment. Be happy to be here. Because when you want something more, you can't enjoy where you already are. And this is about enjoying where we are. So all the wanting to let go, the wanting to do it quickly, that is the problem. Maybe there should be short meditation retreats for the different groups where meditation and some Buddhist teachings would be helpful. Like, for example, troubled teens, recovering alcoholics, people who suffer from anxiety, depression, etc. Do I have to teach that? That's a very good idea. Whoever had that idea, you can arrange it and teach it. It's so easy to have ideas, isn't it? I remember years ago I said, oh, we should have a retreat centre. It took me about 5 or 6 years to build this. It's all right having ideas, yeah, but actually doing them. Anyway, could we please have more question and answer sessions, since there are more deeper questions now that we are near the end of the retreat? Very good idea. You answer them. Do you have any tips on how to remember to eat mindfully? Despite having meditated for many years now, I still rarely remember to be mindful when eating. Even as I sit down to eat and tell myself after the first few mouthfuls, I have forgotten. And the more enjoyable the food, the faster I eat. This means that I don't get to enjoy it as much as I might. I often eat everything on my plate before realizing I have overfilled my stomach. My body tells me afterwards that eating mindful would have been a lot kinder to it. Help! It's a very good technique. So I've asked Bianca to put a cockroach in the food. You don't know where it is. But one lucky meditator will have the curry with the cockroach in. And you know there's one there somewhere. It means you'll be very mindful what you're eating. You're eating this cockroach. It's not the cockroach, it's the cockroach. So is Bianca here tonight? Where is she? No, she. So if anyone finds a cockroach, please give it to Bianca. We can put it in the food tomorrow. So who knows? You know there's one there. That makes you very, 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 very mindful. Okay, there is that mindfulness of eating practice. And that is the one spoon at a time practice. Which means that when you eat your food, your fork or spoon, you've got one on the spoon waiting. Because you've already got something in your mouth chewing. And this one is waiting. And there's also a pile on your plate coming third. And you're already looking for what's coming fourth. So actually you're mindful of about four spoons ahead of yourself. So what you should do, one spoon in your mouth, chew it, taste it, swallow it, before you put anything else on the spoon. Only when you've swallowed, then put something on the spoon. And don't go sort of piling up things on your with the empty spoon while you're swallowing. No, the food is as it was, one spoon in your mouth, taste, chew, swallow, and then even decide what's the next thing going to be on your spoon. One spoon at a time. Practice. So you can get your person sitting next to you to help you. So if you've got two spoons, they can, with the fork, bang it. Let's see what happens. It'll be good fun. After 6 days, even the kangaroo finally let go. Which one is the kangaroo? I don't know. Anyway, that's too mystic for me. Here we go, my first mindful lunch today. I can see the effort and patience. I hear the happiness and joys. I can smell the bliss and sensation. I can taste the gentleness and kindness. And I can feel the love and care. So that's actually the lunch of happiness. Now I need to go back, let go of all senses and go back to meditation. Very good. Yeah, be enjoying your food. That's okay. Ajahn, I have a question where your answer may help people who are like myself. I am tolerant, patient, and try to be generous too, acting as a true Buddhist. But my behavior is not accepted by many, and as said the other day, they judge me as weak, a female who has joined the family from another faith,
often criticize my behavior, going to the extent of making untrue allegations. What is your best solution, please? I have ignored this matter for too long now. Thank you for your advice and most valuable advice. Okay, sometimes Buddhists are a bit too passive. And so there is this classical story of the bad snake. Once upon a time there was a bad snake. He was mean, malicious and vicious. He would bite people for fun. His fun, that is, not anybody else's. And he was such a bad snake that people would keep so clear of him. But when the snake was getting old, he decided to think a bit. What happens to snakes when they die? Do snakes get reincarnated? Is there a special hell for snakes? Or a heaven for the good snakes? Just like any other human being, he started to get religious when he goes old. And many people who go to churches and mosques and temples, they're old, because they're a bit worried about what's going to happen next. So, he started to feel religious. And he heard that not far away, there was a holy snake. The holy snake lived on top of a mountain. And he had a nice little retreat center. And so the bad snake decided just to go and check the guy out. So one day, he actually had to go incognito because, you know, he would ruin his reputation because this was a really bad, mean snake. You know, he's more time in the pub than in the sort of the church. So he decided to wear a disguise. He put on dark glasses, a raincoat and a hat. And he crawled up. He went to the back of the hall, and there in the hall was many little snakes, just like you, listening in rapt attention to what the holy snake was saying, sitting on a high chair. And the holy snake was saying all sorts of interesting things. And the longer the bad snake listened, the more inspired he became. First of all, he was just interested. Then he was really encouraged. And finally, he was converted. So the bad snake took off his raincoat and dark glasses and all the other snakes. Look who's come. This bad snake has actually come to the temple at last. And the bad snake came right up and said, look, I've changed. I've seen the error of my ways. I've been a bad snake for so many years. I've never kept any precepts. I've hurt so many people. I'm so sad. And the holy snake did a forgiveness ceremony. You can let go of your past. But now I want you to keep the 5 precepts from now on. And be a good snake. It doesn't matter what you've done in the past. It's what you're doing now is more important. So the bad snake became a born-again snake. And he went down to where he lived by his hole. And from now on he was always going to be good. He even became a vegetarian. And when people saw him, they never realized he changed, because he couldn't actually tell people, even though in the story I told he had an Amnesty International badge on his chest. But still they didn't realize he was a pacifist. It was only one day that someone walked right past, they were mindlessly doing something else, and they walked right past the bad snake, and the bad snake didn't bite. He was just sitting cross-coiled in meditation with a beautiful smile on his face. And they realized from that time on that the snake wasn't dangerous. So they didn't bother making any detours. But once they realized the snake was a pacifist, just like your friends, the person who asked this question, they started abusing that snake. First of all, calling you names. They said, you're not a real snake. You're just an oversized worm. You're a slimy creep. He actually was a creep. Because that's what actually snakes do, they creep. But he didn't like that, because now, being called names is not nice, but the snake couldn't do anything. Now, in the old days, he would just chase them and bite them, and that would shut them up, but now he couldn't do anything. And even some naughty boys threw sticks and stones at him, and he couldn't defend himself. And they came even closer with the sticks and beat him over the back. And when he was taking the beating, he realized that just being passive doesn't work. In this world, you've got to be tough and mean to defend yourself. And if you're just too passive, people take advantage of you. And so after taking the beating, he decided to crawl painfully up to the holy snake to get release from his vows of keeping the 5 precepts and not biting anybody. And as he came into the room, he was all bloody and bruised. And the holy snake said, "What has happened to you?" And the born-again snake said, "It's your fault with your stupid religion. What do you mean it's my fault, said the holy snake? You told me to keep 5 precepts and be good and be kind and not to bite people. Look what's happened to me. In the real world, you've got to stand up for yourself. You've got to bite. Oh, you stupid snake, said the holy snake. Oh, you idiot snake. Oh, you weak-minded idiot, said the holy snake. What do you mean? Said the born-again snake. And the holy snake said, it's true, I told you not to bite, but I never told you not to hiss. Because as a snake, that's all you need to do. And people run a mile. That's why even here, you see these spiders. They're just going to look at you, and you run a mile. They're only doing that so you don't abuse them. So, they're really passive snakes, passive spiders. They won't harm anybody. They just want to make sure you don't step on them by looking mean and nasty. So that's all you have to do when you go to work. Look mean and nasty. Hiss. But don't bite. That's the story of the bad snake. I better carry on because it's getting late and it's almost people's bedtime. Is experienced jhanas essential for enlightenment? Is experienced jhanas sufficient for enlightenment? Or do we also need to learn the Buddha's teachings and contemplate them? Yes and no. So they are necessary for enlightenment. So without the experience of jhana, you can't get fully enlightened. That's actually said very clearly in the Mahamalukyaputta Sutta. If you don't experience the jhanas, you can't become an anagami, a non-returner. No more than you can get to the pith of a tree, the heartwood of a tree, without going through the sap and bark, through the sapwood and the bark. Is that sufficient for enlightenment? No. Otherwise, Devadatta will be enlightened. You also need to learn the basic teachings of the Buddha. So you need the jhanas and the teachings, the two together, and you can become enlightened. So, you have enough teachings. Now all you need is the jhanas. And there's lots of time left. What day is it today? Thursday, isn't it? So we've got another day and almost 2 days. That's another 48 hours. That's another 2,800 and... That's what, 2,880 minutes. That's about, come and help me, 150,000 seconds. 150,000 opportunities to become enlightened. It only takes a second to see the Dhamma. So you've got 150,000 opportunities left. There's plenty of time. So you can go have a sleep tonight. You've got money, thousands left. So you may actually do it. Anyway, the last question. Cats have 9 lives, and we are only slightly better, 7 lives. Is there any... That means cats must be streaming us. No, of course they're not. Come on. Anyway, is there any evidence to support the 7 life theory? Well, I haven't really done enough statistical tests on arahats and streamliners. We haven't really got a strong enough sample base, but I'm sure that some sociologists will actually put an advertisement in the Buddhist newspapers. Can we please have some arahats and streamliners so we can do this test? And of course it takes 7 lifetimes there to get the results. I read a book of a lady who was reborn 86 times under hypnosis. That means she was born under hypnosis? No, a lady who has had remembered 86 births. She's really got a very good memory, which shows you that if you get reborn and meditate, you don't have Alzheimer's disease. I know that some people can't even remember very much at all. This lady remembered 86 times. That's under hypnosis. Actually, you can access things through hypnosis. So 86 lives, that must be a very good memory. So who knows? Who were you in your last life? But 86 lives, she must be pretty fed up by now. 86 births, I mean, she'd been married many times, 86 times. Now gone to school 86 times. Gee, you get really fed up going to do the same old things. She probably heard all my jokes over 86 times. That's really boring stuff. So anyway, yeah, maybe that's true. So, I don't know how many lives have you got, but we say we're reborn every morning when we wake up. So that may be what it meant as you remember to get reborn, waking up 86 times. So tomorrow morning, have a lovely day. Tonight, have a lovely day. There's many hundreds of thousands of seconds left. Anyone could even be fully enlightened. So don't waste a moment, because the moments are ticking away very fast. So many days have gone. How many days are left? The answer, who cares? The only time you ever have is right now. So if right now you feel happy, peaceful and energetic, meditate. If you feel tired, rest. So be kind to your body. Make peace and be gentle. And for those of you who really want to become enlightened, again, try the Ananda method. See what happens. Okay, everybody, good night. See you in the morning. Another day, another chance to become enlightened.